Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior years shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. Although I didn't go to San Francisco in the summer of 1967, I definitely had hippie tendencies and dreamed of wearing flowers in my long hair en route to the Haight-Ashbury. Instead, I was a cocktail waitress in Lake George before my senior year at Syracuse University. I listened to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and that's about as close as I got. But the Summer of Love was the anniversary this year. AARP has produced a retrospective of the momentous time. I will read it along with the recent articles on what became of the hippies and their legacy. From Venture, Where Are the Hippies Today? From Soapboxy, Origins of Hippies and Lasting Effects of the Hippies, plus the Stately's Best Cities for Hippies. So starting with AARP, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. 50 years ago, a tiny part of the boomer generation tried to change the world. Did they succeed? By Robert Love and illustrated by Peter Max. Part 1, The Gathering. They streamed into San Francisco by rail, car, and thumb, packed into VW vans on foot, ready for whatever was about to happen. They came cradling their youthful idealism. Some even wore flowers in their hair, as a popular song that summer suggested. Many of the 75,000 newcomers arrived without enough money, a place to sleep, or food to eat. Certainly only of their destination, and 25 square blocks of the city's rundown Haight district. Once there, they took drugs, made love, made music, raided thrift shops and Salvation Army counters, and together hived into being a subculture that changed the world we live in. How did it happen? Over the previous months, gatherings called be-ins, love-ins, or happenings had drawn crowds of up to 35,000 in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. But now school was out, the weather had turned warm, and Haight-Ashbury beckoned. We were five guys in a VW van, off to look for America, says Abe Peck, 72, a professor of communications. Me, with my hair growing out after my call-up in the Army Reserve from Fort Dix to the East Village to the Haight. It was crazy, crowded, and not a little cruddy, remembered 60-something journalist Mike LeFevre, who hitched to San Francisco from Portland, Maine, and stayed in a $2-a-night hotel in the Tenderloin District. What was cool was that you could join a group of strangers anytime, anywhere, and you knew you'd be accepted. You only had to walk out your door to join the fun. Time magazine estimated the total number of hippies in 1967 to be about 300,000, which sounds like a lot, but amounted to just 0.15% of the U.S. population then. By early July, the magazine devoted a cover story to exploring the philosophy of the new subculture, but it could have just asked the Beatles, who a couple of weeks before had debuted a song that summed it up in five words: all you need is love. What those kids flooded into Haight-Ashbury had in common was not much, really, except this. They had left their parents and their lives back home, believing deeply that something better was happening somewhere else. Oh, they also believed a few other things, according to the conservative author and satirist P.J. O'Rourke. You name it, and I believed it, recalled O'Rourke of his hippie days. I believed love was all you need. I believed drugs could make you a better person. I believed I could hitchhike to California with 35 cents and people would be glad to feed me. I believed the age of Aquarius was about to happen. With the exception of anything my parents said, I believed everything. There was something in the air. In his new book, In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea, author Danny Goldberg interviewed dozens of people who were touched by that summer. He found a near-universal recollection of a period of communal sweetness. There was an instant sense of tribal intimacy one could have even with a stranger. Part 2, The Tribal Telegraph. It was a great cultural revolution, says pop artist Peter Max, whose euphoric rainbows and psychedelic colors will always remind us of the 60s. More on him in a bit. Out of it came the peace movement, ecology, natural foods, yoga, meditation, animal rights, and great rock music. From Hendrix, Dylan, the Beatles, and the Who, Ravi Shankar, the Mamas and the Papas, and so many others. For Jam Wenner, who co-founded Rolling Stone magazine in 1967, the music was the catalyst for the rest of the revolution. Rock and roll was the tribal telegraph, he says. Ideas about the world were being shared. The ideas about the American experience were being informally passed around. Those ideas included respect for the elders of other cultures and religions, if not one's own, and a reverence for the earth. Young people flocked to gurus, took up meditation, practiced yoga, and recalibrated their largely suburban American taste to embrace other cultures and cuisines. And the year's music was epochal. The Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the singles Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane before the summer was done. That year, the Doors released their debut album. There was new work by Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, Aretha Franklin, and the Rolling Stones, and the era-defining album by the Moody Blues, Days of Future Past. What's more, the hippie spirit of inclusion changed music itself. Suddenly, the wild diversity of American roots music, blues, folk, jazz, country, bluegrass, zydeco, found wider audiences with young listeners who were open to new sounds and experiences. Part 3, The Scavenging. In the same way, the hippies joyfully raided the attic of America's past, reclaiming art, music, design, and fashion that had long ago been discarded in the pursuit of the modern. Hip young men appeared on San Francisco's streets in top hats and high-collared Edwardian suits, their girlfriends in ankle-length dresses and lace-up boots. Blue jeans, work shirts, and granny glasses were adopted by both sexes. This mashup of tag sale vintage fashion was titled Old Timey by the hippies, and it's been a staple of youthful style ever since. Poster artists hired to tout rock concerts reclaimed Victorian display fonts, took lessons from the Art Nouveau poster movement, and created a distinct period in popular American art that combined fanciful 19th century design elements with great splashes of psychedelic color. Along with fashion and art, these historical borrowings extended to the hippie kitchen. The nutritional staples of co-op kitchens were old-fashioned brown rice and vegetables, both cheaper and healthier than the convenience foods many young people had been raised on. Deborah Madison, the author of The Green Cookbook, a landmark vegetarian tome, recently told the New York Times, "We were using wholesome foods in contrast to our mother's new reliance on cake mixes, white flour, TV dinners, and that sort of thing. Convenience and fast foods have hardly been replaced in the American diet, but the hippies' health food did introduce the cultural mainstream to organic produce and the benefits and superior taste of whole grains and grass-fed meat." As the Times declared with a wink, the hippies have won. Part 4. Did the hippies really win? On October 6, 1967, a mock funeral procession commemorating the death of the hippie marched through San Francisco, following a coffin filled with beads, incense, and flowers. The local stalwarts of the counterculture couldn't wait for the visitors to depart. Mary Ellen Casper, one of the funeral organizers, said, "We wanted to signal that this was the end of it, to stay where you are, bring the revolution to where you live, and don't come here because it's over and done with." My former Rolling Stone colleague, Paul Scanlon, 73, lived in the Haight that summer, and by August, he'd had enough of the buses full of gawking tourists that clogged Haight Street. The scene had become a hopeless mess, and it had happened quickly. Thousands of revelers drifted away to communes, campuses, jobs, haircuts, even parents, forever altered. Still, though, the summer of love fizzled in a few months. The counterculture it birthed continued on. Shortly after the hippie funeral in San Francisco, the rock musical Hair opened off-Broadway in New York, introducing theatergoers to the radio listeners and the age of Aquarius. 2 years later, Woodstock drew 400,000 young people for 3 days of peace and music that became a muddy cultural touchstone. The ideas of the Summer of Love had been set loose in mainstream American culture. They fueled the anti-war movement. They fueled the environmental movement. We weren't very politically sophisticated, but our hearts were in the right place, said Lefevre. We helped end a needless war in which many of us lost friends. A lot of us held on to our values, but now we tend to write checks to causes rather than getting together to protest. Though we can decry the hippies or mourn them, what's not deniable is that our world has improved in ways that can be traced back to that summer. The air is cleaner, the nation's rivers no longer catch fire. We can find healthy organic food in the supermarket, and our children and grandchildren go to great outdoor rock festivals dressed in feathers and torn denim, though those glad rags may cost 100 times more than they once did at the Salvation Army. Even in the parts of the country that are most conservative, older Americans have become quite used to more personal freedom than our parents ever had, and more ready to accept a bit more weirdness in ourselves and our neighbors as we grow older and weirder. Americans who drop out in favor of alternative lifestyles can easily find like-minded souls, a patch of earth on or off the grid, and the freedom to pursue their vision. You may not personally partake in premarital or extramarital sex or ingest medical marijuana, for example, but if you're like most Americans, you don't wish to throw people in jail for doing it. Our mainstream culture took what it needed from the hippies, said historian Douglas Brinkley, and what we needed is forever in the nation's bloodstream, whether you bought into it back then or not. We dress our babies in tie-dye and feed them organic oatmeal while Sergeant Pepper's plays in the background. So perhaps we should just say thanks for what turned out to be a groovy little bend in the long river of American history. And now about Peter Max, an American artist. He captured the essence of the 60s with his bold psychedelic paintings, and he's still hard at work. He has painted popes, presidents, Beatles, and American heroes. His color-blasted kinetic images have been expanded to 40,000 square feet to cover the hull of a Norwegian cruise ship and shrunk to the size of a postage stamp for actual 1974 U.S. Postal Service 10-cent stamp. He has worked on sections of the broken Berlin Wall and at teeming Super Bowl stadiums. He has been praised on the covers of Time, Life, Newsweek, and New York Times Magazine. He has been famous since the 1960s, a decade he defined perhaps better than any other visual artist of the time. Yes, here he is in the act you've known for all these years, Peter Max, now 79 and working harder than ever. Evidence of which is the beautiful Summer of Love commemorative cover wrap that was commissioned for that issue of AARP. He says, Jimi Hendrix, The Who, The Dead, Zeppelin, The Beatles, I paint to this music all the time. I stay busy and it feels good. Peter was born in Berlin and raised in China, Israel, and Brooklyn, but he is an American artist. America is the land of creativity, he says, And like a true American, he doesn't mind combining art and commerce under the right circumstances. He has done his share of work for big corporate clients, including NASCAR and Coca-Cola, and he'll consider projects that appeal to him with their energy, usefulness, beauty, and benefit, he says. He is vegan, a meditator, a yogi, and a longtime environmentalist and defender of human and animal rights. Peter chose to pull back from the glare of celebrity during the 70s, but has since returned to the limelight, creating, for example, posters and portraits of all 356 firefighters who perished in the September 11th attacks. He has been the subject of over 40 museum exhibitions worldwide and says he travels almost every weekend to gallery shows across the country, meeting my fans and dedicating my works to collectors. He isn't exaggerating. He was in San Antonio in August and Atlanta and Nashville in September. If you can't make it to a show, you can watch a video of Peter at work in his studio at aarp.org/magazine. And now from Venture Articles, where are the hippies today? Back in the 60s, the hippie movement seemed to be a worldwide phenomenon that would last forever. This is partly true because hippies do still exist, and there's even New Age hippies, neo-hippies, or modern hippies now, depending on what you prefer to call them, that are trying to follow the ideals and principles of the original ones from the 60s. But the hippie movement is nowhere near as prominent or influential as it was back then. Those who have lasted through the years and stuck to the lifestyle and way of life they swore to follow as teens and young adults are far and few between. Sometimes they are so different now than how they were when they were younger that it can be hard to recognize them for what they once were. So, what happened to the Love Generation and where did they all go? Where are the hippies today? To answer that question, we'll have a look at different places in the world, different lifestyles, because they didn't all up in the same place. Professionals. A large amount of hippies ended up becoming successful in various fields and professions. Many of today's CEOs of large corporations were once hippies themselves, or at least claimed to have been. Steve Jobs of Apple Computers was a perfect example of this. According to Steve himself, as well as many of his peers, he was once close to being a full-blown hippie when he was younger and during the very early days of Apple's beginnings. He once said that taking LSD was one of the most important things he had ever done in his life, and he had also traveled to India briefly to partake in the hippie culture that had developed there, in search of spiritual enlightenment. Other ex-hippies stayed closer to their original roots, such as those that have had major success with medical marijuana dispensaries in and around California and other states with medical marijuana. There's also many who even went on to become lecturers and teachers. And a good number of them are some of the professors we are seeing today in some of the country's top colleges and universities. Parents, many ex-hippies felt they had to grow up and become more like the rest of the people around their age in society because many became parents. Becoming a parent can be a life-changing event for many people, even hippies. But nevertheless, there's still many who still have that hippie culture in them. Many have even managed to pass their hippie ideals down to their children and grandchildren by taking them to concerts and decorating their homes like a commune. Author of this says personally he grew up as a teenager in the 90s, but had a friend whose parents were still hippies in their older ages. They had a room that was entirely dedicated to the Grateful Dead, as it had nothing but GD posters all over the walls, black lights, beads hanging in place of where the door normally would be, and all of the hippie things you'd come to expect. They had followed the Grateful Dead concerts across the country as teens and were still obsessed with them after all this time. But who could blame them? They dedicated a large portion of their life to that lifestyle, so probably enjoyed it and didn't want it to change. The hippie trail. For the hardcore hippies that took their way of life as far as they could, many ended up in places like India and Thailand as they followed what was once famously known as the hippie trail. Many visited countries in Asia and ended up staying there, becoming monks, swamis, or just party animals that are still dancing nude under the sun on some days like they did during the original Summer of Love. Goa, India is probably the most famous spot where most of them traveled to and decided to stay. But homelessness. Unfortunately, many hippies of the 60s had a hard time integrating back into modern or corporate society, and they remained on the streets. Many of the homeless people you see in the downtown section of your nearest city were most likely hippies at one point and probably still hold on to that mentality today. Lots of them would rather live free of possessions and stress and live the way nature intended, while others have lingering addictions and drug problems that probably first started during their experimentation days of the 60s and 70s. Then there are those who live in communes tucked away from society and living as natural as they possibly can. These types may be considered poor or homeless by society's standards today, but to them, they are rich in spirit and freedom, and they are already home. This is from Soapboxy by Tracy Lynn Conway, September 2016. Origin of Hippies. Here's what I learned. Hippies of the 60s most likely originated from a group that first emerged in Germany between 1896 and 1908, when a youth group began to reject organized social and cultural clubs that centered on German folk music. Instead, they encouraged amateur music, creative dress, communal living, and outdoor activities like camping and hiking. Inspired by the works of Friedrich Nietzsche, Goethe, Hermann Hesse, and Eduard Balzer, this group called Wandervogel, migratory bird, attracted thousands of young Germans who rejected the rapid trend toward urbanization and yearned for the pagan, back-to-nature spiritual life of their ancestors. During the early 1900s, the Wandervogel settled around the United States bringing these values with them. Many were attracted to California, where they could follow their lifestyle in a warm climate. What remains today? Laws that protect the environment became part of the U.S. government and global agenda. Earth Day, the Green Movement, and concern about a person's carbon footprint all have roots in the hippie culture. Interest in organic food, herbal remedies, and vitamins all go back to this time. Due to the hippie movement, we now have acceptance of multiple personal lifestyle choices, including acceptance of unmarried couples, rights of homosexual, bisexual, and transsexuals. Frankness regarding sexual matters also originates with this movement. Hippies, like their Wandervogel predecessors, encouraged a wide range of clothing options that live on today. The option for men to wear mustaches, beards, and long hair was not only a fashion statement, but a form of rebellion against the norms and expectations of society, and has remained acceptable due to the hippie movement. Many people now attend free music festivals. There's open access to information that the internet offers, also believed to stem from hippie influences. Websites like Napster, which offered free music, and WikiLeaks, which promotes government transparency, all share connection with the hippie influence. And from a Stately blog and Ryan Nickum, while some may think all hippies have burned out or faded away, the truth is they're still out there, still busily making love, but not war. We here at Stately set out to find out what communities still were heavily concentrated as hippies, and well as providing ideal habitat for the next generation of flower children. To determine this, we used a formula based on marijuana availability and legality, number of stores selling hemp, local counterculture icons, tie-dye availability, hippie festivals, progressive government, intensity of Occupy protests, and a Facebook poll. In the end, we determined these places. There are 17 best U.S. cities for hippies, and they are, beginning with number 17, Arcata, California, Bloomington, Indiana, San Francisco, California, Manitou Springs, Colorado, Berea, Kentucky. Number 12 is Oakland, California. 11, Missoula, Montana. 10, Bisbee, Arizona. Going on to Austin, Texas, Berkeley, California, Ithaca, New York, Burlington, Vermont, Portland, Oregon, Boulder, Colorado. And the final three, Asheville, North Carolina, Olympia, Washington, and Eugene, Oregon. Let's go and talk about Ithaca. Ithaca holds the record for the largest human peace sign, an accomplishment that only scratches the surface of this city's true hippie nature. This central New York town has its own currency called Ithaca Hours, which is essentially good for 1 hour of work that can be traded between local residents. Now that's groovy. Here's something more about Ithaca. In 2000, Ithaca's residents churned out more votes for Ralph Nader than for George W. Bush. And it would have been even more if Nader had paired up with Dennis Kucinich. The city is home to astronomer Carl Sagan, the influential hippie eatery, Moosewood Restaurant, and Namgyal Monastery, a branch of the personal monastery of the Dalai Lama. In short, it's a hippie heaven where residents are practically required to have a minimum of 10 bumper stickers supporting social and environmental causes. Well, where were you in the summer of love, 1967? What were you doing during that time of the hippie era? Were you too old to participate? Too young to participate? Maybe you were too mainstream, or maybe you were part of it. It's the age of Aquarius that we remember, and I remember well seeing the musical Hair for the first time. No matter where you were during that wonderful summer, I'm sure we all have some incredible memories about it. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you'll join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.